Hi, this is WWR Win Wise Radio.
Win Wise Radio.
Hi, this is Harley Keisch.
I'm Susan Lockwood.
And we're coming to you from high atop a not-so-windy mountain in the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts.
Tonight we are happy to welcome Lisa Linos, who is the founder and executive director of the Industrial Wind Action Group, a national advocacy group focused on issues associated with industrial wind energy development. Joining Lisa is Julie Johnson, founding member of Union Neighbors United, which was organized to advocate for safe setbacks when the Buckeye Wind Project first came to light. Lisa and Julie work together at the federal level.
Good evening and welcome to WindWise Radio. I'm Harley and I'm here with my beautiful co-host in our deluxe studio. How are you tonight, Susan?
Very well, thanks, Harley.
Well, I just wanted to start off. I got an email tonight, just before the show. This email came to us from the folks out in Falmouth, Massachusetts, specifically Dave Moriarty of East Falmouth, asked that we put a notice out, and I want to do it. Tomorrow on Monday at 7 p.m., there's going to be a municipal meeting at the Lawrence Middle School in Falmouth, Mass., to discuss and vote on Article 23 on their town warrant. What's going on is that in Falmouth, there were about 50 families that were adversely impacted by the turbine that was known as Wind 1. And we're actually going to have at least one of those people on next week on our show. We're going to talk about people that have been directly impacted. There's a movement afoot among some of the people in Falmouth to try to turn the turbine back on. The families had fought successfully to have it shut off just a few months ago, and were celebrating probably their first Christmas in quite a while where they could be enjoying the peace in their own homes. So the warrant they're going to try to vote on is going to try to keep those things off. So Dave is asking everyone who can come to join him and his neighbors in a standout, a demonstration of concern and solidarity with the victims of the negative effect of the poorly sited turbines. The standout's going to be outside of the middle school, Lawrence Middle School, at 6 p.m. There will be signs provided, and you're welcome to bring your own. This is going to be a very important moment in the lives of those Falmouth neighbors. They've already reached out to a lot of us to warn us of what happens when industrial wind turbines are sited too close to people. For more information, you can contact Dave Moriarty at wavydavie@aol.com. That's WAVEYDAVIE @AOL.com. Or you can call 774-521-8474. Again, that's 774-521-8474. They've done a lot of good work to support all the efforts around Massachusetts and elsewhere where people are facing these similar situations, and they've given of themselves far more than you could expect anyone to, and now's the time for us to give something back to them. So I just wanted to read that as an important message. And then I want to introduce our guest for this evening. We have Lisa Linos, who is with us, I hope, still, after my lengthy little thing there. Are you still there, Lisa?
I'm here. Thank you, Harley and Susan. Thanks for having me.
Good evening. Good evening. And we also have Julie Johnson from Ohio, and your group is called
Union Neighbors United.
Union Neighbors United. And you've been at this for almost 6 years, is that correct?
That's right, Harley. Thanks for having us.
you're welcome.
Can I just take a second to let everybody know that Lisa is from New Hampshire, and our other guest is from Ohio.
And they've been working together for quite a while. Do you guys know about how long you've been collaborating on various things?
We were just trying to decide how long ago, and it has to have been years, at least 4 or 5 years that we've known each other. But I can't, and Julie, I don't know if you remember better. It's been a while.
I don't know. I just know that when this whole thing surfaced in Ohio, the first thing we latched onto was Wind Action, and And it was a lifesaver to help us get to the information we needed to start talking and learning and educating ourselves and others. And it's a process that goes on today.
Yeah, unfortunately, we haven't beaten them back. You know, on CBS Face the Nation today, our vice president, Joe Biden, was on, and I guess the topic turned to the production tax credit and the fight that's been going on in Congress or in the U.S. Senate, really, for the last, about 4 weeks in intense fashion, and for much longer, obviously, than that. And the quote that I picked out of the interview was, he says, quote, "They're emasculating all the efforts to deal with renewable energy." And I guess he's just a little mad. Maybe he's a little spiteful. I don't know. Maybe he's just not feeling that great about things. Because I'm actually quite happy that, you know, due to the efforts of people like Julie and Lisa, we have now defeated the reinstatement of the production tax credit, which is this huge subsidy for turbines here in the United States. It's 2.2 cents per kilowatt hour, which drives so much of the ridiculous proliferation of these devices. So I just wanted to say thank you to both of you for the part that you had in there, and I want to ask you a lot of questions about how that's been going and what that how do you have an impact in the United States Senate. Lisa, can you tell us a little bit of the story of the last four destructions of the effort? I mean, they've tried four times now, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there's the production tax credit as well as Section 1603.
Now, what's 1603? What is that?
The Section 1603 was implemented as part of the stimulus package voted into law in the February-March 2009 timeframe. That was when this was following the collapse of Lehman Brothers and the market in the summer, fall of 2008, and a lot of the available taxable income that would normally find its way into wind development while we had investors seeking to take tax credits, that money dried up. So the federal government jumped to the request of the wind energy, primarily the wind energy industry, and said, well, we will just eliminate the middleman being the investor, and we will provide the money directly to you. As opposed, so the production tax credit was, while still available as an option for developers, was quickly replaced by Section 1603. That was the name of it. Section 1603 was the section of the law that the stimulus. And what that meant was that wind developers seeking to build a project could file with the federal government and receive a direct cash grant representing 30% of the capital cost of their project, provided they met two deadlines. At the time in 2009 when that was adopted, they needed to get their project started by end of December 2010, and in service by the end of 2012, so the end of this year. And so that particular bill or that section drove a tremendous amount of wind energy development.
What's making it possible for all these marginal like projects to go forward on a financial basis. I mean, there's no other way, right?
Absolutely. I mean, at least with the production tax credit, it has its issues, but the production tax credit does require that a project produce energy. So it is for every kilowatt hour of electricity generated and put on the grid, the developer received a tax credit, which of course goes on to the investor. So there's an expectation that the project is producing. In the case of Section 1603, that money is granted to them upfront, and the project, as long as it goes in service is kind of the nebulous concept. It has to put some energy on the grid, but it could stop operating as soon as they receive the grant, and no one's going to look back and take that money back.
So I have another question. How are these developers vetted? I mean, how do they know that these people are legit operators and that this is a site that's actually worth developing?
It's not. They're not vetted. Basically, they have to come. The only guidelines that are established is that they have to meet the deadlines. And that at the end of December 2010, when we went through the fight over the tax extensions, this would have been the Bush tax extensions, they did extend 1603 by 1 year. So now they had to at least have started their project by the end of December 2011 now, and they have to be in service by the end of this year. That's really, and the only other component that is evaluated by the Treasury now, it's the Department of the Treasury that reviews Section 1603 grant outlays, cash outlays, is that they have to make sure the costs they're submitting as being eligible, because again, it's 30% of eligible capital costs. They have to make sure that those costs that they're submitting are eligible. There's been a minor pushback by Treasury. They found that, for instance, one project in Illinois stated that they at least submitted more costs than the Treasury. There was a dispute as to whether or not some of their costs were eligible. So there was some pushback there, but that's about it.
Hmm. Wow. So there was no oversight from the, what is it, the Office of Budget and Management? What is the big,
OMB?
The OMB, yeah. Yeah.
No oversight. Because the law is a poor law. I mean, it did not care. At the time when the stimulus was put in place, there was just a very hard push to make sure we were creating jobs and we were getting projects moving and people had something to do. And of course, renewable energy and wind energy happened to be the favorites. And, it's always been particularly popular with federal government and particularly with this administration. So there was no, they weren't looking that deeply.
Is there a good record of success for job creation, green job creation that's coming?
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, I'm going to give you a couple of numbers because this will astonish you. The production tax credit has been in place since 1992. Okay, so, and we'll talk more about that. But I mean, people have talked about whether or not they argue the production tax credit has driven a lot of wind energy development. Well, in 2005, we didn't have much in the way of wind energy development. And there are a couple of years from 1992 up to that point where we had 1,400 megawatts installed, 1,500 megawatts installed. In 2005, under the production tax credit, we had 2,200 megawatts. 2006, we had 2,600 megawatts. Then come the production tax credit being replaced by Section 1603, we're now into the 10,000 megawatt installation. So 2009, we saw 9,989 megawatts installed. In 2010, it was about 5,000, but it's been running in the 5,000 to 8,000 megawatt range, much higher than what we saw built under the production tax credit, because this was such a overly generous form of subsidy. And I'm glad it's expired now, but we're still going to be dealing with the ramifications of that, but that particular subsidy.
So if I get myself a piece of land right now, let's say mm-hmm. I go out and I get my carpet bag, I go out to, Illinois or Turbinois or one of those states out there, and I go out there and I lease some land from some farmer. They don't know anything, right? They're all hicks. And so I can't get this sweet deal anymore? Or what's the current deal? I mean, what?
You can't, right. There's an effort afoot to bring back 1603 as well as the production tax credit. And I want to talk to you about that. In 1 second, I just wanted to let you know, you asked me about the question of jobs. That's a really important question because the American Wind Energy Association has put out that the industry has had in 2008, 2008-2009, 85,000 workers, what they characterize as direct and indirect workers. So direct workers would be people that work explicitly for the wind industry. The indirect workers could be anyone from the waitress that's working at the diner that now has a job because a wind project is going in, to the lawyers that are promoting, helping to get the projects approved. It's a much wider range of what that means. So when 1603 was implemented in 2009, there were 85,000 jobs claimed by the American Wind Energy Association. By 2010, that dropped to 75,000 workers. So it was not a job creator. The wind energy, the industry is not a job creator. The renewable industry overall is not a job creator. And when you see the kinds of costs associated with above market costs on energy, we're actually seeing a high risk of losing jobs in other sectors because we're pushing forward sources of generation that are very expensive. But in terms of 1603, that policy expired officially at the end of last year, at the end of December 2011, which means that if you have a project that you want to build, unless you had either shovels in the ground by December 2011, or you had a substantial amount, there's a rule called the 5% rule, some percentage of your capital costs already committed and are spent by the end of December 2011. If you did not meet those criteria, then you are not eligible for 1603, and you will now fall back on PTC, production tax credit.
Now, the last time that I got one of your communiques, there was a feeling like this wasn't going to come back again anytime soon. Because the last time, it was just last week, right? That on, was it Wednesday or...
Yes,
it was
Thursday.
So Thursday, 51 to 47, I think, if I'm recalling correctly.
That's correct.
The attempt to reinvigorate this whole thing, bring it back from the dead, failed again. One of my state senators, the Republican one, Scott Brown, voted nay, and John Kerry voted yay. And I think it was pretty much a party split, wasn't it?
Yes, we had, unfortunately, our two senators from Maine did vote for, as we were part of the voting in favor. It needed 60 votes to pass. But that vote is a little bit difficult to interpret because the vote, what was before the Senate last week was the Menendez 2204 bill, which was calling for an end to certain tax benefits that are eligible, that the oil and gas industry is a bit eligible to receive, as are other large capital-intensive industries eligible to receive. It's calling for an end of those specifically for oil and gas and taking the money saved and using them to extend the production tax credit, extend Section 1603, and extend other subsidies that have or are expected to expire for the renewable industry. And the actual vote that took place on Thursday was not on that bill. The actual vote was whether or not they should end debate on that bill.
Oh, okay.
And when that failed to meet the 60-vote threshold, the entire bill was withdrawn from the floor and it just went away. And so it's difficult to interpret the meaning of it, but it was clear. A lot of people felt there was, including four Democrats from oil and gas states, clearly they felt that there was too much that needed to still be debated before they proceeded with any kind of vote in that.
All right, so what's the next likely, because I just don't trust them. I think that they're going to try once again to bring this back. What's their next vehicle?
Yeah, you're right not to trust them. The next vehicle, there is a standalone bill that was presented by Senator Bennett out of Colorado, Senator Grassley from Iowa, and also Scott Brown out of Massachusetts and several others. And that is a standalone bill that seeks only to extend the production tax credit, and I believe it is for 1 year. That bill is, my colleagues that are advising me in the Senate are very certain that that bill is not going to come forward on its own, and that the next effort on the production tax credit, it's quite frankly, it's not even clear now anyone's going to touch 1603, because that a lot of people now realize how expensive and how problematic that the policy was. So it's all about production tax credit now. And that is likely to come through in the form of an amendment. It's unclear at what point that we're just going to have to watch them on a weekly basis to see if they'll come through with an amendment on some other bill that goes to the Senate.
So can you explain what the difference is? There's like a germane and non-germane amendment. Isn't there a rule that says that the voting has to be different? Or I'm not sure.
Yes, in fact, what happened with the transportation bill a couple of weeks ago, and we thought that this whole thing would end then, or at least give us a break. And the transportation bill, which went through the Senate several weeks ago, in the middle of March, there were a number of non-germane bills, or amendments that were put forth by senators on both sides of the aisle. The non-germane amendments are amendments that have nothing to do with transportation, but they look like, since this is a transportation bill, it's perceived as a must-pass bill. They were looking to get some of the other kinds of,
So people hang these things like ornaments on a Christmas tree.
Absolutely.
And they think they're going to go through because they can't vote the primary bill down because it's so important. So they think they can, sort of ride the coattails of this, like, more important legislation.
Yes. And that's what happened, and there were a number of amendments that were put forward, including one by Senator Bennett again.
What's his problem? What's his major malfunction?
Well, he's from the state of Colorado, which has asbestos, has been supplemented quite nicely by the state of Colorado to build their manufacturing facilities. So they build blade manufacturing facility. They build blades in Colorado, and they might do nacelles too. I can't remember.
He's involved. Basically, this U.S. senator's involved in the shipping of large portions of our tax dollars over to Denmark, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. He'll claim that there's 6,000 jobs at risk in the state of Colorado if asbestos disappears. And asbestos made a clear statement in November 2011 that said if the production tax credit dries up, the wind industry will fall off a cliff. Well, asbestos will probably be harmed by a production tax credit going away. So
I can't go on. I'm so broke up now. Asbestos is going to be hurt. Oh my, Susan, you'll have to take over. I'm sorry. The thing that made me the most angry was this deliberate, blatant attempt by people like Vestas and these other Windies that they're using the jobs issue like some sort of club to blackmail senators and other politicians in the U.S. to give them their tax dollars, or they're going to take all their toys and go home or something. Did that make you angry? I mean, it made me angry.
It's maddening to see how people fall for it, but at the same time, it's not clear whether they're really falling for it or just afraid of saying no to renewable energy. But what is stunning, what really was stunning in that particular vote, this was on the transportation bill, was that it failed. No, I don't think people expected it to fail. And it failed by a 49-49. Two senators have not been voting. So it was a 98 senators voting. It was a 49-49 vote, and it failed to extend the production tax credit in 1603. And what that demonstrated, and what's becoming more apparent, is that it's not so clear that there is bipartisan support for these subsidies. And they'll go around and say, well, maybe it was just 1603, or maybe there are flaws in the amendment. But the fact is, it's not apparent that the Senate, which many had thought was going to be friendly towards these subsidies and committed to having them extended, it's not clear right now.
Now, Julie?
Yes.
Who are your two senators in Ohio? I should probably, is it Voinovich or?
Sherrod Brown.
Sherrod Brown.
A Democrat from Cleveland.
Okay.
And Rob Portman, a Republican from Cincinnati.
How do they end up voting?
On party lines.
Oh, right. They split just like my state.
They split. And you might remember that Rob Portman was the director of OMB under Bush, and he's very concerned about the deficit. I've met with both of my senators personally, and we enjoy one little special thing here in Urbana, Ohio, which is nowhere in the world, but Senator Portman's godmother lives here.
Uh-huh. There's always a connection.
Connections are really important. I just wanted to chime in. One thing is... I think that as the days go by, we see one unintended consequence after another. And with respect to the 1603 grant program and the stimulus program, I'm not exactly sure whether this was under 1603 specifically or it was just a move in the president's stimulus bill. But AK Steel Company in Middletown, Ohio, down near Cincinnati, very close to Senator Rob Portman's area, received a grant to develop renewable energy using waste heat recovery and cogeneration. And they were racing to try to get this particular facility built this year, or they would lose their grant money. In order for them to go forward and receive the full benefits of building this waste heat recovery facility at their steel plant, they needed to open up Ohio's renewable definition and enable them to meet Ohio's renewable portfolio standard. And
oh, nice.
So we have, Lisa and I have talked somewhat about, as these things progress at the federal level, sort of in a belt and suspenders scenario, that if they lose the production tax credit at the federal level, the next arena is going to be the focus on the state renewable portfolio mandates. And so we have had a big fight here in Ohio on behalf of AK Steel to open up the definition of renewable energy to something other than or in addition to wind and solar. And wind has been fighting that like fury because it will ruin the REC market for them, the renewable energy credit market for them. It will damage it because it will lower the cost or the value of the renewable energy credit. Tom Stacey, my wonderful colleague here in Ohio, and I have been testifying in the legislature in Ohio on behalf of AK Steel. They were surprised and delighted. They thought we were angels that had come down from heaven. They're our new best friends. The wind industry succeeded in limiting the eligibility for waste heat generation to AK Steel specifically and no other steel plant or no other manufacturing facility in Ohio. But that bill raced through, and we learned that big steel is bigger than big wind. And now the next step step will be, we've kicked the door open here in Ohio, and in the governor's proposals for the budget going forward and his energy proposals, he wishes to open up further the definition of renewable energy much beyond wind and solar, and his director of the Public Utilities Commission testified in the legislature last week, interestingly saying that Ohio's renewable portfolio cannot be wholly dependent upon unreliable and intermittent sources, that it was a risk to our state.
Now,
wow.
you're saying
great.
That is great. So you're not only an angel, but you kind of also play the role of Daniel going into the lion's den, don't you? Aren't you
yeah.
a member of the Wind Working Group of Ohio?
No. They dissolved.
You dissolved them. That's like the end of the Wizard of Oz. Did you splash water on them or something?
Yeah, we did. That's true. The Wind Working Group was about to publish their best practices and policies for Ohio, and in those best practices were a minimum half-mile setback from a property line.
Oh, great.
And at that time, the setbacks in Ohio were, and continue to be to this day, 750 feet from the tip of a blade at a 90-degree angle to your house.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, for a 492 turbine, it sure is. But the wind industry saw which way the wind was blowing, and convinced the governor to disband the group prior to the vote.
He said that's enough work for you guys. Thanks.
Yeah.
Bye.
Yeah.
Well, that's unfortunate because that means that the original siting guidelines stand.
Yes, that's what that means.
Yeah, it's the 750.
That's
Ohio's
horrible.
Minimum.
Now,
yeah.
Our wind working group seems to be, in Massachusetts, seems to be working in the totally opposite direction from where what you were able to do within the structure of what was yours. So that's very interesting. You were quite influential in. How many people from our side of things, as I like to say, were on that committee when it was dismissed? Sent home, sent packing, said...
Just me.
Just you. And so you were able to turn... it was a bunch of wind lobbyists and developers on there, right? That's what... That's typically...
Yeah, there were. There were. And, you know, it's interesting how one's past lives come back, but I worked in state government for 8 years before getting into banking, and like I think state government in Ohio is like the Hotel California... You can check out anytime you like. You never leave. And, so there's so many people that I worked with in the governor's office who are still involved today, either as lobbyists or members of different state agencies. So I was able to, after 20 years, go back and recharge my old network, and that's been very helpful.
Do we need to get you some money for like a bodyguard and stuff? Because I'm
not yet, but hold that thought.
All right. You see.
So wait. I need to get something straight. So you were single-handedly able to convince all the rest of the people on this wind working group to change the siding to the setback to at least half a mile.
Yeah, we were there.
Wow, you are a very convincing person.
But, you know, it wasn't just me. We had a wonderful facilitator, and I don't know if you are all familiar with it. It's an old book, but the National Academy of Science produced a book on wind turbine siting, gosh, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago. And it's a thick book, and it's wonderful. And in it, it states that people within a half a mile are going to have a problem.
Wow.
So, I mean, they could. So once that was pointed out to them, they couldn't very well say, well, the National Academy of Sciences needs to be disbanded immediately.
Right. So that was a very powerful thing and difficult for the wind industry to rebut.
Now, I think we want to take some phone calls from if anybody's interested from our listeners. I think we have some. We actually have some people that want to talk. So I'm going to take a couple phone calls, and then we're going to go to a little bit of a break. So I just want to. I know they've been holding for a while, and I want to get them on. The first phone call is from Rob from Vermont, who wants to talk about the next day market and forest buying of wind energy and so forth. Rob, are you on the line?
Yes.
Hi,
yes,
Rob.
Hello.
Good evening. Thank you for listening and for calling in. What's your question for
Thanks
our guest?
For the show.
Thank you.
My question is the fact that there's an oversupply of electrical generation in New England, and there are certain situations, one that I'm aware of in Maine, where I think it was the Stetson Wind Project built a transmission line to go to Orrington, Maine, and coming out of Orrington, Maine, south to the Maine-New England grid, there were already two generators on there that are baseload generators. One's a hydro, I think, and one was, I'm not sure, a gas plant. I'm not sure what the other one was. And they're baseload generators, so they bid ahead to sell their power in the day-ahead market.
Okay.
And they get guaranteed to have it, and they're guaranteed to have it purchased. So what happens in this case is when the wind was blowing, the project, I think it's a first wind project, worst wind. They get priority or whatever. They get to sell their wind power whenever they're producing it, whether anyone needs it or not. And the other generators at times are asked to back down or curtail their output. What people don't understand is when that happened, they've sold their power in the day-ahead market. They're guaranteed to get their money. So they back down. They don't produce the power. They don't put it on the grid, but they're getting paid for it by the ratepayers anyway.
Oh.
So the wind is not only useless and redundant, it's just a third unneeded cost.
Do you guys have a comment? Do you have a question for? Do you want just a?
Yeah, I'd like to expand on what that. And Rob, thanks for your questions, Lisa.
Welcome.
What Rob is talking about is how energy is bought and sold in most of the country, and this would certainly be the case within the ISO New England grid region, that will be the six states of New England, certainly the case in New York ISO, which has its own grid region for that state, as well as PJM grid region, which would be most of the Mid-Atlantic states. It's expanding westward as far as Illinois and some of North Dakota. And that is the method of selling energy. And what happens is on any day of the week, sometime around 12 o'clock, all of the generators in the region, let's pick on New England since you talked about the Stetson Wind Project in Maine, all of the generators will state and submit a bid and state that for every power hour of the following day, they will generate X number of megawatts in that hour. And that all of those bids are submitted sometime around noon. By 4 o'clock in the afternoon every day, the ISO New England, here in New England, processes those bids and then it establishes the price of electricity for those generators for every hour of the following power day. So if I'm a natural gas plant and I'm 100 megawatts and I bid in and at 12 o'clock noon for the following day, I'm going to produce 100 megawatts, my entire generation. I'm going to be paid an established amount of money that was established price based on all those generators that submitted. So now here comes a big wind. There's a huge wind storm that comes through in New England at 12 o'clock that day, that power day. And there's more energy coming on the grid than can fit because the transmission lines can only hold so much. I, as a natural gas plant, I happily bid that. I will back down. I am happy to, if I'm to the extent that I'm able, I will shut down my plant. I will still get paid for the 100 megawatts that I did not supply, and the wind guys will get on the grid. The wind guys will get paid not that price. They'll get paid the spot market price, which is a different price, and typically lower. And there I go. The idea that more wind on the grid is going to back down natural gas, and therefore we don't have to pay for natural gas, is not representative. We're paying the wind guys to go on the grid because they're able to, and we're also paying the natural gas guy to back down. So there is no savings of energy. In fact, it's more expensive. And the situation in the Stetson project, we had a transmission congested situation. This was back in 2008 to 2009, where we had two renewable energy projects on the grid at this one transmission point. One was a biomass facility, one was a hydroelectric facility. Together they represented 150 megawatts, just a little bit more than that. They were already at maximum what the transmission was capable of handling at that location. Stetson built First Wind built a 57 megawatt wind energy facility called Stetson 1, linked right in at the same location. There was no room, and the study that came back from the ISO New England said, okay, if wind comes on, one of these guys has to back down in order to allow room. And we ended up with a situation where there was no net increase in renewable energy in New England. The governor, Bill Gauci, in Maine at the time, proudly stood in front of Stetson and said, now we are adding more renewable energy into the grid. Fact is, Stetson was displacing other renewable energy. And those guys, of course, are much more reliable. They were happily back down to the extent they could because they would still get paid.
Well, Baldacci is a well-known hoser, as my friend Greg would probably say. In the papers here in Massachusetts, we had this past week, they were trying to shove through this energy cost savings measure for renewables. And in the paper, like a day later, it said it's only going to cost us another $940 million above what we would have paid if we hadn't done the wind energy. So it's craziness from start to finish, as far as I can tell. I'm not a financial guy, but it just makes my brain go snap.
Carly, it's stunningly more expensive than that. That is a watered down representation of how much more expensive, because they're comparing it to onshore wind, offshore wind. If you compare it to natural gas prices today, natural gas today is around 3 cents a kilowatt hour at the wholesale level. And Cape Wind right now, its contract wholesale is over 19 cents.
Holy mackerel.
It is unbelievable. And by time, and if the PTC disappears, it goes up over 20 cents.
Right. Well, Rob, thank you very much for your call. I'm going to take our next caller. Thank you for listening to our show, and I hope that you'll continue to participate. We really appreciate it. It looks like we weren't able to connect with John. I'm sorry about that. Well, listen, we're going to take our quick break for some public service announcements now, and we'll come back. Hopefully other people will try to call in. The phone number is 213-943-3683.
On Saturday, April 14th, 2012, from 1 to 3 p.m. in Port Elgin, Ontario, there will be a town and country revolt parade featuring Dale Goldhawk of Goldhawk Fights Back. Ride your tractors of all sizes, trucks and trailers, decorated cars too. Assemble at 12:30 in the Port Elgin Industrial Park, across Highway 21 from the Independent Grocery Store and beside the Plex. The protest parade begins at 1 p.m. going south on Highway 21, ending at the Caw Gates. Walkers, welcome to join at the top of Bruce Road 25 and Highway 21. Bring a sign!
Wind power, it's sustainable.
It burns no fossil fuels. It produces no air pollution. What's more, it cuts down on dependency on foreign oil. That's what the people of Meredith in upstate New York first thought when a wind developer looked to supplement the rural farm town's failing economy with a farm of their own, that of 40 industrial wind turbines. Windfall documents how this proposal divided Meredith's residents as they fought over the future of their community. Champaign County Wind brings two free showings of Windfall to Ohio on Sunday, April 29, 2012 at 3:30 p.m. at the Champaign County Community Center at 1512 South, U.S. Highway 68 in Urbana, and then Wednesday, May 2, 2012 at 7 p.m. at the Graham Middle School Auditorium at 9644 West, U.S. Highway 36 in St. Paris. Call for more information, 937-653-2884.
In Toronto, Ontario, on Tuesday, April 3rd, there will be a wind power convention protest. Gathering will be at 11:30 a.m., speakers at 12, protest march at 12:30 p.m. Beside the CBC building, opposite Metro Toronto Convention Center, where the FIT, Fleecing Individual Taxpayers, convention is being held. Local groups, please coordinate buses and attendance for your own areas.
Maine can learn a lot from Denmark. The Danes are the world leaders in wind power, the inventors of the wind farm, and the home of Vestas, the number one manufacturer of wind turbines. Where the Danes go, the world of wind power follows. The Danes made big news recently because of two major decisions. They first slashed subsidies to the wind industry. Second, they banned all new land-based wind farms due to public anger over noise and loss of property values near turbines.
The Danes are still way ahead of us. Please visit the Friends of the Highland Mountains at www.highlandmts.org.
This is WWR, Windwise Radio. If your group has an announcement they'd like read on the show, please send them along, and we'd be happy to help. Okay, well, we are back, delighted to have both Lisa Linnaeus and Julie Johnson on with us tonight, and we've just been discussing all kinds of problems with the lame legislators that seem to line the corridors of Capitol Hill these days, to use a turn of phrase anyway. And we have a couple other callers that we're going to bring on in a second. Time is becoming short in the show. It always goes very fast. But I did want to ask a quick question of my own about, and I think Julie touched on this a little bit, about it seems like there are these common threads that run through where if the wind developers don't get their way at the federal level, they go to the state legislatures and the governors, and they put pressure on there. And they tend to use the same strategies over and over again, whether it's the loss of local control through a siting bill that takes away the rights of the local communities to site turbines and so forth. So I'm wondering, do you see that as an ongoing problem? Is that something that we're getting a handle on? What do you think, Lisa?
It's astonishing to see. That's exactly what's happening. I mean, they will flow to the location where they think they will get the most receptive hearing. And if at the local level there's pushback over a project in a state where local control is enforced, they will go to the state to push their point. They will, the federal level is an overreaching expectation. They long expected that the federal government will support what they wanted. This is really the first year X number of months where they've been seriously challenged. I don't think that they expected that, but it is forcing them to even push harder at the state level. And what's happening at the state level, interestingly, is that most of the states that have RPS, renewable portfolio standards, in place, which are mandating renewable energy in their states, they've had them in effect for several years. And all of these policies, for the most part, had a requirement that the legislatures go back and reevaluate the RPSs to make sure that they're working as they were expected. and they're being challenged. They're in a number of states, such as what you heard in Ohio from Julie. So, but there is what's shocking. I'll just make this point. They follow the same process, but you know, Julie and I and many people have been in this fight for a long time, and we've learned a lot in the process and have evolved our arguments based on new information. Yeah, as recently as last fall, I was on a radio show where I was sitting in the same room with Iberdrola, a representative from Iberdrola. And to hear the same arguments that we heard back in 2005, 2006 coming from Iberdrola, to which we could easily push back now, our side can easily push back, it tells me that our arguments are not getting out there enough. And so I hate to think that we're talking to ourselves more than to the people that need to be listening to us, but apparently we haven't challenged enough. So they're playing a similar, following a similar playbook over and over again.
Okay, we're going to take a couple calls, and then I think we're going to have to end, but I want to get these calls in. First, we're going to take a call from Art, who is from Vinyl Haven, Maine. And Art, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for calling. I want to try to, I know you want to get your question out, so I'd like to let you do that. What's your question tonight?
My question is, I was just up in over the border in Canada, and an American company is planning on placing a turbine in Canada and operating it from the U.S. And my curiosity was whether they get the same production tax credit or any of the other subsidies if they do that, that come from the U.S., the federal government.
You want me to answer that?
Sure.
Hi, Art. Thanks for your question. This is Lisa. If the project is located in Canada, it is not eligible for the production tax credit. However, the reason we're seeing a lot of development in the northern part of areas in Canada, north of New York and New England, is because they are eligible for our renewable portfolio standards here. So that means they're getting the RECs, the renewable energy credits, which there's right. No equivalent to that in Canada. So not the production tax
That's
credit,
right.
But the RPS policies they're eligible for.
The RECs, which
yes,
is generally
right.
The major part of the money that gets passed, doesn't it?
Certainly in New England, and it varies. I mean, the cost, the RPS is the big difference between the production tax credit, let's say, and the RECs, renewable energy credits, which are what are paid under the state policies, is that the RPSs, the REC values vary depending on supply. So if we have a lot of renewable energy feeding into the RPS market, then the RECs go down. It's a supply and demand. The REC value of the REC goes down. Several years ago, RECs in New England were trading for around $10 a megawatt hour. Today, shockingly, there's not our mandates have gone up, and other factors have caused the RPS REC values to be up in the $60 a megawatt hour. So if I'm a wind guy, I'd be wanting to build in Canada and participate in the New England RPS markets. A lot of money.
Lisa, is this...
Okay.
This, Julie, I just wanted to ask, is this why I think it's Minnesota and Wisconsin are pushing back on letting hydro compete for those renewable credits?
Absolutely.
A lot of that comes down from Canada.
Yep. Yeah, then, and unfortunately, on RPS, what you were talking about earlier, Julie, RPS... policies, state by state, define what is a renewable energy. What is renewable energy? And it varies from state to state. But in New England, they're pretty much uniform with some modest changes. That is, the six states of New England have pretty much the same RPS by state. And none of them allow for large hydro. But they'll allow for small hydro under 5 megawatts and some incremental on large hydro, but by and large, hydro is out.
Well, Art, thank you very much for calling. I'm going to take our next caller, and I hope that you continue to listen in and participate. It's very important to us. that we we have amazingly intelligent listeners. So thank you very much.
You have quite well.
Have a good evening. Okay, and I think they dropped off, but let's see. We're going to take this next caller. Hello, you're dialing from the 928 area code. I don't know your name, but I want to bring you on.
Yes, I am.
Who is this?
Linda.
Hi, Linda. This is
Linda.
Harley. How are you doing?
Yes, we're doing fine.
Where are you calling from?
Sorry, I dropped off before, but I'm calling from Arizona.
From Arizona. Okay, so I know who you are. So what's your question tonight?
Yes. Well, what I was asking about, wanted to ask about, was whether or not Lisa and Julie have run into issues where it's obvious they have a lot of federal connections, where they have found projects that are being fast-tracked and actually pushed through by the feds, regardless of local opposition or whatever.
I'm not sure I understand the question. Are you asking if the federal government has pushed through these projects? Despite
you
local
have any experience with the federal government pushing through or fast tracking.
And what?
Go ahead. Julie, do you want to answer that, or do you want me to?
I couldn't hear the question exactly. Was it that it is the federal government behind pushing some
have
of these projects?
Yes. Have you had any incidents where the projects you've been involved with have been being pushed through, fast-tracked by the feds?
And I'm just going to clear that up. So, Linda, what do you mean by fast-tracking? Can you give us a bit?
Well, our project had to have an EA done. An EIS, Environmental Impact. Not the full one, but the small one, the EA.
Okay.
And it took them exactly 3 months to go from the scoping meeting to a finding of no significant impact on this project.
So that's pretty
and
fast.
And nobody could believe that it was done in 3 months.
And was that a federal environmental impact statement, or was that the state that was doing it?
It was federal.
It was federal.
It was federal.
Linda's exactly right. It is a significant problem, and I can tell you that I experience. We know that it is in the process of happening on Cape Wind, even though Cape Wind, this is the offshore project off the coast of Nantucket, even though it's been debated for 10 years now. When Secretary Salazar was brought in, there was no question that project was going to get approved, and whatever objections there were, he was going to make it happen. We see the same kind of thing happening with the wind projects being proposed to be built around the Kingsville Naval Air Base down in Kingsville, Texas. You'd be shocked at how the federal government is ramming through these projects, wanting to get them built, despite the fact that they are going to have a significant impact on radar. The radar installations in the Corpus Christi Kingsville Naval Air Base area, and may render that naval base ineffective. We have the same thing happen in Oregon, where the project, this is the Shepherd's Flat project, which there was a significant impact on radar in that area. This is not radar that you have by your airports. This is radar that is our national security radar that is watching for incoming enemy targets coming from Canada, over from the Pacific, you name it. That project was rammed through despite objections from the federal government, by the military. And I had the same thing happen with the project here in New Hampshire. In this case, it was a project in northern New Hampshire, 99 megawatts. It had 13 acres of wetlands being filled, 33 miles of new road built on three mountaintops. The Fish and Wildlife Service said that there will be a problem because of the impact. The environmental groups came back and said there's a problem and we should do an EIS on this. But the Army Corps listened to the state government, who said, we want this project built. You backed down, and they said, well, there's no need for an EIS. So it's happening in a lot of different ways, and in ways that you will not necessarily see. It'll be decisions being made behind closed doors where you're not invited. And it's very difficult to get our arms around it, but even publicizing the frequency with which this is happening, it's been a very difficult thing to get out there.
Hmm.
It's maddening. Yes. Maddening.
Well, thank you,
thank
Linda.
You very
We're,
much.
You're welcome, and I'm going to be in touch with you, as you know. And thank you for calling. We're going to have to wrap the show up now because we're a little bit past our time, actually. Thank you guys for coming on. I know it went very quickly, and it always does. Unfortunately, we can never get to quite all the things that we want to talk about.
Thanks, Harley. Thanks, Susan.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thanks, Harley.
Thank you, Julie.
Thank you.
You guys are doing wonderful work. We're honored that you came on. And the mountains, the deserts, the prairies, all are in your debt. So we'll talk to you soon, I'm sure. Bye-bye. That was a good show. Again, I mean, it's just you learn so much every time we have one of these. And those two women are just amazing. What do you say, Sue?
I say they're amazing.
It was
very, very informative. I'm very appreciative.
Now, what's happening next week?
Next week is our victims show.
So the people that have been directly impacted are coming on.
Yes.
There's a fellow from West Virginia that has a sound meter that he uses to measure sound outside his house every day.
Yeah, that's well above what anybody should be having to listen to.
It's frickin' ridiculous. Hey, this is Windwise Radio, and we say good night. Have a good night and a turbine-free night.